Well, thank you for coming to sit or just for the talk. Our practice, in one way, seems to be a little complicated, especially if you're new to it. And those of us who've been doing it for a while remember it's a little bit complicated, because then we say, oh my gosh, of course, all these things we have to explain, you know. And that things are complicated kind of fits into our story. We figure anything valuable probably is pretty complicated. Probably there's a lot to learn. A lot of classes we could take and books we could read. A lot of new knowledge we could accumulate and obtain and possess. And even though we have this sort of structure and container that does have some details to it, part of why I wanted to offer the opportunity to practice quietly all day was for us to remember that it's also very simple, very fundamental. That really waking up to our life is just on a moment. It has nothing to do with knowledge or how clever we are. It has something to do with just turning towards one breath, attending to one object carefully with our hands, listening to one sound. And it's natural that we would want to know, well, where would all that lead? Where would this practice lead to? What would it get us? And I think we all have some ideas about this. Otherwise, we wouldn't be here. Some of our ideas about what practice will get us, I think, are pretty vague. We're not really quite sure, some sort of rough sense of things. And we have some very explicit ideas. I would like to be something. More something. And the trajectory and feeling of practice is different for every person, because each of us comes to this so unique, so perfect in our imperfection. So it's hard to really say anything about where all this leads. Whatever you say is not right for everybody, maybe not right for anybody. But one thing that we can do is we can examine examples of people who have been practicing a while. By just being with people, with teachers, with senior practitioners, being in the Sangha, coming to the Dharma Hall, and also reading and learning and listening about longtime practitioners. What qualities do they exhibit after 30 years or 40 years of practice? Because it turns out this is a slow process. A year or a month or 10 years is not very long. If we really want to turn and transform a life which has been building up momentum and trajectory and baggage for already 30 or 40 or 50 or 60 years. Someone was just telling me that their life feels like one of those ocean tankers, you know, that are like a mile long. And it takes like a long, long time to turn them, you know, or stop them. So life is a little bit like that. Sometimes there are big experiences, sudden realizations, important moments that you can look back on later. But I think most of the time, it's more like that. You turn the rudder, and at first, you turn the rudder and like nothing happened. So you want to give up, right? I'll forget about it. I'll turn the rudder the other way. But really, you just need to wait. The ship of life will slowly turn. So this morning, I thought we'd look at a particular teacher in our lineage as an exemplar of practice, just to see what we can learn. And some of you are here, about a month ago, I read to you a nice tribute from my teacher, the guiding teacher from afar of our community, Norman Fisher, a tribute that Norman Fisher, himself a teacher, wrote about one of his teachers, his Dharma transmission teacher, Sojin Mel Weitzman, which he had written in honor of Sojin's 80th birthday. It was a beautiful little piece. But it turned out that that piece he wrote was actually an essay for a book, which I got a hold of. Has some nice sort of loose American calligraphy on the cover. It's called Umbrella Man, a book of similar tributes from all of Mel Weitzman's, from Sojin Roshi's deshi, from his Dharma transmission students. And so I was quite impressed by the book, and today in my talk I want to give to you a sort of impressionistic reading of the themes in the book in Umbrella Man. And so I'm going to just pick out some themes and read quotations. And I'm not going to attribute them or anything. I'm not going to kind of complicate it with the story of who said what or why or anything like that. So it's a little impressionistic and out of context. So you should read the book if you want to know what it's really about. This is just my gloss, you know, my selective reading. Which is, of course, what we do, right? Whenever we read anything, we're not actually learning what the author intended, right? We're taking what they intended and reading with our eyes. So here's my little tribute to Sojin Roshi, whom I sat a few seishin in a practice period with one time. But I don't know him well, and he probably doesn't remember me. And I want a little bit of historical background to make a few of these make more sense. This is a teacher at the San Francisco Zen Center area, but not exactly at San Francisco Zen Center. He was a student of Suzuki Roshi, author of Zen Mind, Beginner's Mind, whom we mentioned in our dedication this morning, sort of founder of this lineage family in America, Japanese teacher. And Sojin was a direct student of Suzuki Roshi, was ordained by Suzuki Roshi. And then Suzuki Roshi asked him to go and start a Zendo in Berkeley, across the bay, which he did. And then what turned out to be really powerful and important about Mel is that's pretty much all he did. He started a small center at first in the attic of his house, and then later the community bought a building. He lived there the whole time, set the schedule. He never wrote any books. Now there's a book about him, but he never wrote any books, or I don't know if he ever like even wrote any articles in like Tricycle Magazine or anything like that, you know. All he did was tend to his center, take care of the students, take care of his practice for now like 45 years. And then what happened at San Francisco Zen Center is after Suzuki Roshi died, one of the other students, Richard Baker, sort of inherited the throne, as it were, and was a different style of teacher from Sojin. Baker Roshi was very charismatic and exciting, brilliant man by all accounts. I haven't met him. Very insightful, organizationally like a superpower of his own. Acquired major properties for the community. You know, if I was Richard Baker, we would have owned this building years ago, you know. It's a good thing we don't. And you'd be really mad at me by now, if you're not already. He would love me and be really mad at me at the same time. So they had this charismatic teacher, and as often happens, and especially happened in the middle, in the 70s and they're into the 80s, in many communities, Richard Baker, because of his hard work, felt very deserving of many things and took a little more than he should have and had to leave. And then what ended up happening, sort of organically, is Sojin became kind of the closer, like the you know, in baseball. My son's into baseball now, so I'm thinking about baseball again. Well, you can't pitch a whole game, hurt your arm. And so in the end, they bring in a pitcher for the last couple of innings. So Sojin has been the closer, the final pitcher for many important teachers now in that lineage, because Richard Baker left, didn't complete their training with them. So that's referenced a lot in the book. And some of the, I won't read too much of the organizational stuff, which I found interesting, but it'd be boring probably to you, but several people are quite candid in the book, which they probably couldn't have been then, saying, you know what, I always think Mel was pretty much a fuddy-duddy that didn't know anything off there, you know. We were doing the important work, you know, in San Francisco, and he was off there doing his thing, you know. Who really cared? But now I get it, you know. Now I see that he was actually keeping the flame, quietly keeping the flame of Dharma alive while we kind of went crazy, you know. So anyway, that's a little background on this. So these are quotes by different people about working with Mel. Some of them did serve a sort of traditional Zen apprenticeship where you study with the same teacher the whole time. But that's not, you know, that's the sort of revered model. But I think in reality it's not as all that common. So a few people did get to do that with Mel, but most of them it was like that. They studied with other teachers and only studied with Mel for a few years towards the end of their training. So happy birthday to Mel. Steadiness, devotion, and endurance. It seems to me that the main characteristic of Suzuki Roshi's teaching and of Soto Zen is faith, steadiness, and endurance. To keep going with the practice no matter what. As Dogen taught so profoundly, the practice is enlightenment. There is no enlightenment outside of practice. In the early days, and I know it is the same now, it was clear, without anyone ever needing to say so, that this value was the value most encouraged by Mel, this steadiness. They were sitting every morning at 5 a.m., and Mel was there every day, always on time. Whether there was one person or two or three joining him, and there were seldom more than three or four in the early days, he was always there, sitting in his place at the head of the stairs, so that when you walked up the stairs, you would see him first, just there, always there, motionless and quiet. Generous and steadfast. And he was steadfast. So now this is a different person speaking. So it's different quotes. And he was steadfast. Now that I look back on those years when he was in the hinterlands and the big Zen thing was happening in San Francisco, Mel was quietly running his smaller center in Berkeley, he just steadfastly practiced, taught, and followed his way, followed Suzuki Roshi's way. Just a tremendous steadfast quality and nothing fancy. Mel is not a very fancy person. No frills. Very different. That flavor, very different from the flavor of the way Richard Baker taught. Humble. Associated with all this was a tremendous humility. When Steve Stuckey, Paul Haller, and I did Dharma transmission with Mel at Tassajara, their monastery, in 1993, each of us had to do this long series of ceremonies. Finally, after the final Dharma talk, we all went up to Suzuki Roshi's ashes site up on the Hogback, so to the cemetery. We offered incense and bowed, and then Mel was standing in front of Suzuki Roshi, and the three of us were a little ways further back. Mel looked at us and said, "I'm not so good, but you are good," and went on to say that passing on the Dharma to us was a good thing, and that we would manifest it in a good way. Good things would happen. And this statement, "I'm not so good, you're so good, I'm not so good, but you're good," is one of the most important things that anyone has ever said to me. Not because it makes me good, but because the quality of humility there is so authentic. When I teach and practice now, I hope to convey that spirit. Letting go of results. The evolution of my sense of Zazen is a lot about polishing a tile, challenging the whole idea that you're going to get somewhere or get something out of this. Now I'm not as focused on getting something or being in some particular way in Zazen or other times as I used to be. I realize that wherever I am, it's not going to be so good. It's not going to be the way I wanted. So I might as well get used to it. Dogen said, "Those who have great realization of delusion are Buddhas. You know, there's no place to go. The place where you get to be a Buddha, so to speak, is right here in delusion, and there's plenty to go around. You get up where you fall down." That's a good teaching for us. You get up where you fall down. You don't get up someplace else. It's where you fall down that you can establish your practice. That's what Mel manifested when he was talking to me during our training. Supportive, open, friendly, and helpful. He was just assisting me in getting up where I fell down. And I want to mention the reference in there. There's a koan reference in that part. He said about the evolution of my sense of Zazen is like polishing a tile. So there's a koan, a Zen story, where a very eager student is practicing Zazen very assiduously, you know, really hard, day and night, every spare minute, you know, coming early, staying up late, always sitting. And the teacher comes up and stands next to him and then picks up a roof tile. I guess they've been repairing the temple. Picks up a roof tile and gets out his handkerchief and starts vigorously rubbing this roof tile with his handkerchief. Probably standing like right next to the student, like, you know, right here. And finally, the student gets exasperated, stops, you know. And it's a big deal, I don't know if you've noticed as much in this sendo, it's a big deal not to talk, right? So finally the student gets exasperated and has to say something. "Why are you polishing that tile?" Like that, you know. And so the teacher says, "Oh, I'm trying to make a mirror." And the student says, "That's ridiculous. You can't polish a tile to make a mirror." And the teacher replies something like that, "And you can't make a Buddha by sitting Zazen like that." So that's a famous teaching story. So we have to polish our tile, but we need to know it's not going to turn into a mirror. Being upright. One time when I was studying my tendency to want to be regarded as a good guy by everyone, I can relate to that, I asked Mel, "I know true Dharma goes beyond the duality of good and bad, but isn't it valid to choose the good?" After a brief pause, Mel looked me in the eye and said, "Our practice is being upright." Being upright. Connecting to the feeling of practice. When Mel was abbot and I was the Eno managing the Zendo, I wanted to clarify one of the details of Kinhin, the walking meditation. So I asked Mel, "Okay, so when do we hit the clackers?" He looked at me with conviction and said, "You hit them when it feels right." That was his notion of precision. Not a notion of precision or an idea about practice, but an invitation to really feel, to attend to the precision of being in tune with the whole activity. Which makes me think about, we make some effort here to have detailed instructions, you know. It says when to hit the clacker. Which is pretty much a good idea. It empowers people and people can take on new roles, as we have today, which is wonderful. But there's a way that we have to be mindful. We're not just following the script, you know what I mean? To feel the feeling of practice. Working with difficulties. When significant difficulties arose at Berkeley Zen Center, how they were handled was admirable. In a direct way, his senior students could say, "Hey, Mel, what are you doing?" Without defensiveness, he'd respond, "Yeah, you're right." But it wasn't, "Okay, well, then you're not going to be my students. You can't practice here." And it also wasn't, "Well, then you can't be our teacher." Because Mel had trained them and worked with them in a way that whatever the issue, their relationship could be sustained and worked, and it could be worked through. The connection they had was beyond whatever the trouble was. Which is our hope here, I think. There's always going to be trouble. But we have to be able to talk to each other and trust our relationship runs deeper than that. Ordinariness. Maybe you're picking up on this theme. Ordinariness is probably the biggest theme. For me, Sojin's genius is in his ordinariness. Once at a big hospice fundraising dinner at Green's Restaurant in San Francisco, which is like a fancy restaurant, Ram Dass was the guest speaker. I knew that Sojin would be making a speech after Ram Dass. But Ram Dass was a very famous spiritual teacher, and everyone was really excited to see him. So I began to wonder what Sojin would do. How would he express himself to these potential donors and people from the wider community? When his turn came, Sojin just got up and spoke to the crowd just like he always spoke. He was just the same old Sojin. There was no persona, no charisma, no personality, or person to project. Just Sojin, the same Sojin I knew in the Zendo, in the Doksan room, and at staff meetings. It's hard to put into words how much Sojin's lack of desire to make an impression on others impressed me. It's easy to say, just accept who you are. Or as Suzuki Roshi said, when you are completely you, Zen is Zen. But it is really rare to have a living model of this. I am very grateful to Sojin for his embodiment of this teaching. Just being yourself. From this first encounter, I was inspired by what I took to be Mel's ordinariness. He wasn't trying to impress anyone or stand out in any way. He seemed like a very ordinary, accessible person. And yet, in that ordinariness was something that meant a lot to me. It seemed to me that he was the first person I'd met who was settled and at peace with himself. I saw in Mel a form of everyday, straightforward Zen practice that didn't make Zen into something esoteric or mysterious. Appreciating disagreement. Mel wanted to know one time how I understood my relationship to him. I told him I trusted him implicitly, but I didn't know if I agreed completely with his Dharma understanding. To my amazement, he stopped, turned to me, and said in a very direct and welcoming way, something like, "Great, where we disagree is where we can meet." I believe he also brought his two hands together to emphasize that meeting. It's good for us to hear, right? We really kind of want a teacher that we always agree with, and we try to make that the case. Being yourself, not trying to be someone else. More than anyone else, I see Suzuki Roshi in Mel's face. I myself tried for several years to be Suzuki Roshi. "It's okay that you've died," I thought. "You can have my life." But I ended up abandoning myself when I tried to practice that way, and I suffered a lot. But somehow Mel is just Mel, and there is Suzuki Roshi. Deep listening. After my Dharma transmission, I said to Sojin, "Remember, I'm not going to start a Zen group. That's not what I do." He didn't say anything. A few years later, after I'd started a Zen group, and it was thriving, I was again talking with Sojin. I reminded him, with a little embarrassment, of my earlier comment. "I guess you must have known something back then that I didn't," I said. He replied, "Oh, I don't listen to what people say." What he meant was, "I don't listen to what people say. I listen to what people say." I have tried to do just that in my own work as a priest. We can all relate to that, right? Really listening deeply to what people really mean. Just listening without controlling or advising. I have felt deeply known, seen, and accepted by Mel. He was interested. He listened. I was totally neurotic at the time. I had so many problems. His mind was so wide, and whatever yammering was happening in my mind would just float away into the ether as I talked. After 5 minutes of talking to him, my gigantic problems, of which I had many, floated away in his big mind, and there was nothing else to say. So we'd just sit there, quiet and content. He never answered, he never solved anything. I couldn't have articulated this at the time, but I was going there to be with his mind. I would talk for 5 or 10 minutes, and then we'd just be quiet. I'd just sit in his spaciousness. How to teach others, how to help others, we could say. In relationships with people who come to study the Dharma with me, and we can understand that in relationship with people who come to be with us, same thing. In relationships to people, I can see how deeply I've been shaped by Sojin Roshi's way. Om grow up svaha. That's this person's mantra. Om grow up svaha. Take seriously your life as it is. Make it a Buddha field of generosity and mutuality. Sit zazen, be honest with yourself and others, and don't fall for fancy ideas about practice. Just keep at it. As a teacher, you can rely on me to show up and share my understanding, but not to tell you what to do. It is up to you to realize the way. Find joy in the feeling of your feet on the floor. Live in your world. This is some of what I received from Mel. It is my life's work to live out all that I have been given. Just be straightforward. Sojin Roshi values and embodies directness. He cuts through delusion, no hesitation. My experience is that this comes directly from Zazen. He is quite willing to tell me my stuff, to show me my shadow. Usually he is right. It is sometimes painful to hear, but it is helpful. One time I had been harboring ill will towards a dear friend and could not let it go. I found I kept trying to convince my friend that she was wrong about an exchange that had really hurt me. So finally I went to Sojin Roshi and told him about my difficulty. And my difficulty in letting the matter drop. His response was, "Can't you just say ouch and go on?" As is my practice with him, I said yes, implying not knowing what she was going to do, but I said yes and left. But then I practiced with it. I found that I had neither voiced nor even let myself experience the ouch. So I did. First experiencing it, then meeting with my friend and sharing that hurt part. She apologized, we dropped it, and moved on. One thing to notice is we have one person saying he gives me really good advice, another person saying he gives me no advice. So, some mystery here. Working honestly with faults. I have seen Sojin Roshi when he was accused of crossing boundaries. This happened with gay students at Tassajara and with women students at Berkeley. What impressed me was how open Sojin was with his students when they confronted him. Somehow he managed to demonstrate humility and yet not be servile. He maintained his dignity and authority and was able to communicate. And about a year ago, in Shosan, which is like a formal question and answer in front of the community, someone asked him what his greatest difficulty as a teacher was. Without hesitation, he said, "I tend to fall in love with my female students. I work with it by trying to think of them as my sisters." I was deeply moved by his honesty. Boredom is okay. It's the last theme. Boredom is okay. Over the years, Mel's presentation of the Dharma has often put me to sleep. I began to notice, until the unique quality of his teaching began to permeate my bones. Then I would wake up feeling deeply nourished. He would just talk on about the virtues of ordinary conventional life, and he would go through the teachings word by word, reading them again and again. And when Mel and I would meet for Doksan, private interview, every so often, I began to notice that whenever I started to go on about my problems, he would fall asleep. I want to learn how to do this. Often right in the middle of presenting. Often right in the middle of presenting an emotional reaction, something really important that had happened to me, I would notice him nodding. Sometimes he would open his eyes wide to try to stay with me. But when I could bring my voice to an authentic and fresh place again, he would completely wake up. This boring approach has taught me an important lesson about how to meet Dharma in life. When a situation or a person presents itself in an unresolved, undeveloped way, one can meet it with matter-of-fact, self-nourishing patience. Mel's Dharma is to offer a few words and then stay, just stay, until awakening occurs. For some reason, this last quote has been particularly helpful to me thinking about this. And maybe you have some of this too. This great desire to help people, you know, against the odds, no matter what. And this fear of being boring and irrelevant. That impulse to be interesting, to be clever, to give good advice to your friends or your family, to be right and perceptive. So it might really help us to let ourselves be boring and ordinary. Just listening and giving space for ourself and for others. So let me just read off my little names for the themes and then make a few comments. Steadiness, devotion, endurance, generosity, humility, letting go of results, being upright, connecting to the feeling of practice, working with difficulties, ordinariness, being very ordinary, appreciating disagreement, just being yourself, deep listening, without controlling or advising, being straightforward, honest with our faults, and boredom is okay. So I just wanted to note a few things that are not in that list, which maybe we expect of ourselves and our teachers. Nobody talked about how Mel is always right. In fact, there are quite a few quotes I could have given about times they disagreed with him and didn't feel quite approved of. It sounds like he could give insightful advice sometimes, or sometimes just fall asleep. And now this is common sense that no human being can see inside our head, including us, and know exactly what we need. So we recognize our baggage a little bit. Our projections. We want somebody to tell us the plan, to tell us what to do, tell us the next step. And we want them to be right. And if the first person we ask doesn't have it, we'll ask somebody else. So somehow Mel has trained himself to not try to be that person, because that person does not exist. Our teachers, our comrades on the way, can really help us. They can offer another perspective. They can share the feeling of being grounded in the practice and accepting what comes. They can sometimes offer useful advice about how to turn difficulties as practice, like the example of the woman who was mad at her friend. But they can't do anything for us. They can't solve anything. That's up to us. And we won't know either. We just take the next step. So today, I think we really do have a wonderful opportunity to practice Zen in this way. To honor Sojin Roshi, whether we met him or not, or to honor other teachers. By just paying attention. Just sitting when we sit, walking when we walk, standing when we stand. Practicing steadily and continuously for the rest of the day or as long as we're staying. Recognizing the non-difference of zazen, kinhin, service, breaks. Just living the rest of the day, whether we're staying in the Dharmaha or not, living the rest of the day as one breath. Not diffusing our energy by chatting or like sneaking off for a latte. Or reading, but just staying present. Not reaching for something beyond what's offered. To just accept what's offered. And in that is the possibility of real contentment. Contentment with whatever is arising. Even if it's not what we would have chosen or what we wanted, if there are difficult thoughts or emotions, pains in the body, the possibility is there to bring up contentment in the middle of that. And the same thing if we're having a wonderful day. I'm not saying we need to have a miserable day to learn about this. It'd be great to have a wonderful, happy day. But even if we're having a wonderful, happy day, not to get too excited, have some idea we can capture something or grab something or bring something with us for later, store up our happiness in a little box, even in the middle of happy moments, to practice contentment. Letting go. And it might be we can understand this practice best when we remember it's not about getting something. or improving in some way. It's giving a gift. It's giving a gift. Giving a limitless gift to our true self. And giving that gift away to the world. Over and over. So please, let us continue. Thank you very much.
May our intention equally extend to every being and place with the true merit of Buddha's way. Beings are numberless. I vow to end them. Blue.